Our next speaker, although for most of us, Jaggi Singh probably needs no introduction. For those that may not know, Jaggi is an anti-capitalist writer, organizer, and activist out of Montreal. While currently a prominent and active member of the anti-capitalist convergence CLAC in Quebec, Jaggi has been involved in organizing against capitalist globalization since 1996. He was an organizer and participant in the protest against the APEC summit in Vancouver in 97, the MAI negotiations in Montreal in 98, the 2000 OAS summit in Windsor, and most recently, the FTAA demonstrations in Quebec. Please welcome Jaggi Singh.
Thanks, Marnie, and thanks to the organizers for the invitation. And it's great to be spending some time reflecting on this anti-capitalist resistance movement, even though it's a Saturday morning in July, but still. I've been asked to evaluate direct action protest or specific kind of direct action protest that we've seen in Quebec City and Seattle and Washington and Prague, and we'll be seeing in a few days, actually, in Genoa, Italy, against the G8, and to evaluate this as a means for effective long-term resistance to capitalist globalization and for bridging the gap between the North and South, or that is, resistance movements in the North and South. That's a huge topic, and I don't have any huge, profound insights. I'm just going to share some impressions, and hopefully that'll be useful for the workshops that are coming up. In November of 1999, when the WTO demonstrations were happening in Seattle, I wasn't in Seattle. I can't claim to have been there. I was actually in Madras, India. Actually, when Seattle was happening, I was spending a lot of time at internet cafes trying to find out what was going on and being amazed by the coverage that indie media, which emerged, was providing. But I wasn't just hanging out at internet cafes in India, although I spent a lot of my time there. I was interviewing activists, representatives of organizations, resistance movements, and because of Seattle, asking them a lot of questions about what happened in that movement. I spent a lot of time in Madras, in Bombay, in Delhi, but beyond those major centers, I went to Bhopal and Madurai as well. And I think those impressions that those people provided and those interviews are a useful place to start. And I know for me, they made me look much, much more critically at what was happening in Seattle and thereafter. To sort of give a general idea of some of the impressions that people had, I mean, first thing was very positive, obviously, that there was dissent being shown so publicly, although a lot of activists in India felt compelled to add, especially in the United States, because they know about that dissent against the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF, but to see that in the belly of the beast was a very good thing. And some older activists said it's good to see this resurgence of dissent, acknowledging profound movements in the 60s and 70s. Although a lot of the other comments were much more critical, there was a different understanding of what the failure in Seattle was all about. And while a lot of people respected the direct action component, they did not feel that was the result of the failure of the new millennium round. Rather, it was the fact that southern countries, including India, were refusing the demands of the North for labor clauses, environmental clauses, for speeding up the process. There was skepticism of the whole demand for labor clauses, social clauses, and that skepticism mirrored the very demands of their governments, who they really have no time for. So I'm not talking about people who were apologists for big business, whether in the West or homemade big business. These are opponents of capitalist globalization who suffer repression, but they had a skepticism of this call for social clauses, because they felt it was basically used to serve the competitive interest, the competitive advantage of Western capital, that NGOs and Western governments were making a common front. And I wrote an article about it, and I'll just share with you some quotes. There was one Bombay publication who wrote that the big labor unions and environmental groups had demands that almost mirrored that of the U.S. government. Their understanding of Seattle was that it was an indirect fight and that it was subtly reinforcing Western domination. Slogans like fix it or nix it forced people to ask, fix what? why would you want to fix something that's responsible for so much misery in our lives? and other slogans like No Globalization Without Representation, which was a slogan taken up by the Sierra Club and other groups in Seattle, were just plain farcical. To quote one activist, Vigita, a women's activist in Madras, she felt that there should be a direct fight on globalization, and that Seattle was basically looking at the issue with one eye closed by downplaying the voices of the South. I think the organized American working class is worried about American capital going to the third world to exploit conditions there. That's an indirect fight. And insofar as it reinforces Western domination, this is not just simply coming from Western governments, but from NGOs. To give some other quotes, who are they, the West, and this is the governments along with NGOs, to impose conditions on third world countries? People are starving here. Why the hell should they tell us what kind of economy we should have? We will define our own way of life and development, and we're capable of doing so. Who are you to teach us about child labor or anything else? The 3 months I spent in India, or the 4 months I spent in India, were the only 4 months I've ever spent in India. I was born and raised here in Toronto. And really the only time I've spent in the South. But I think those impressions can be generalized over the South. And I think that's a useful place to start to evaluate the direct action movement that we've seen emerging from Seattle. So to maybe give a little bit of an evaluation, I guess the first thing is we have to acknowledge it's very positive that these large-scale mobilizations are happening. They're empowering collective experiences. You just talk to anybody who's at these events, they come back with that sense. There's a sense of possibility that's created from these large movements, fundamental questions that are being posed about how we organize and what we want. People are coming to terms and reckoning with a more complex understanding of the world, getting beyond an analysis that says we want good things and we're opposed to bad things, to a more complex understanding of what those bad things really are, and naming names and giving addresses, as Patrick likes to say. And tactically, the street actions that aim to disrupt and shut down these conferences is a prevailing break with, which is a clear break with prevailing authority, which I take to be a very good thing. There's a crisis of legitimacy, if not a crisis of functioning of these conferences. They have to hold the next WTO conference in Qatar. Quebec had to build a huge fence. A lot of people were arguing that these conferences, the security around these conferences, are just meant to take over and terrorize people. And if they really want to have a clean, sanitized conference, well, you should just go to a ski resort or a cruise ship. And in Genoa, they're going to go to a cruise ship, it appears. And in Canada, where the next G8 summit is supposed to be held, the government is now considering moving it from Ottawa to a ski resort, either Banff or Jasper or Whistler, all of which I think is indicative of the power of these mobilizations. There was actually an editorial in the Montreal Gazette a couple of days ago that was urging, responding to this idea of moving the conference from Ottawa, the G8 conference from Ottawa, to Banff or another ski resort, and saying, why don't they just meet by video conference? We have the technology, and by that way you can just skip having demonstrations that get in the way. Interesting perspective from the editorial board of the Montreal Gazette. And to continue in my positive evaluation of this movement, it's been sustained, almost farcically so, in that all kinds of conferences are being targeted, things you've never heard of before, like the TABD, the Transatlantic Business Dialogue that was protested in Cincinnati. The demonstrations in Washington this coming fall are looking like they're going to be much, much larger than they were last spring. So I think that those are all good things. But all is not well, nor has it ever been. There are problems and critiques to be made, and some things are just plain scary. And I'll get to that in a second. And as people who've heard me speak before know, I tend to pose or address these critiques or problems by asking two questions or exclaiming two things. Whose movement are we talking about, and what movement are we talking about? And in terms of whose movement, I think in the North, there's a real disjunction or gap between sites of direct struggle and these large-scale actions. Particularly speaking, particularly talking about Aboriginal communities, people of color, poor communities. There's a gap between those sites of struggle and these actions. And I think everyone acknowledges that resistance has to be based in community. It's not about traveling, although that's an important part of it, but that the movement is not linked to actual community-based struggle. Patrick made reference to the whole Buchanan mess and alliances with Buchanan, and to address this point, I'm going to quote from an article that really brought this out. It's by a man named Jay Sakai, an article he wrote called Aryan Politics and Fighting the WTO. But in terms of not being based in community struggle, he has this to say. He says, was it the WTO which placed a major sewage treatment plant right in Harlem, knowingly pushing up air pollution levels just as an epidemic of black and Latin childhood asthma was starting? No, that criminal act was committed by our own very local capitalism. But for New York anti-WTO protesters, it might be that Seattle is much closer to them than Harlem, if you know what I mean. And I guess I can sort of undiplomatically say for a lot of people in Toronto, say, Quebec City is a lot closer than Regent Park or St. Jamestown, if you know what I mean. So there's that gap between community-based struggle and these protests. And linked to this argument about, or linked to this critique of whose movement is what I say, what movement? Is it a traveling NGO circus or traveling circus, period? Is civil society synonymous with NGOs whose existence is dependent on governments? Is the working class synonymous with a union bureaucracy that's also tied to these NGOs? Where is the strong international radical network that can link the North and South? There's also, to borrow a term from Jay Sakai again, asymmetrical, what he calls asymmetrical class politics between the North and South. He makes a very useful distinction, I think, between referring to the WTO, but this can be generalized to struggles against globalization or various treaties and institutions. He makes a distinction between the campaign and the struggle. The struggle being mainly in the South for years, for decades, for hundreds of years, you could say, and the campaign, which is mainly led by NGOs in the North. But it's the analysis of those campaigns that comes to dominate the discourse of these large-scale mobilizations. Hence, asymmetrical class politics. There's an international proletariat, but it's the NGOs of the North that dominate this process. Those are some of the problems and critiques, but there's also what I referred to before as a really scary element, and that is the tendency of some forces to make alliances with the right, the far right, especially in the United States. In Canada, a lot of that cultural nationalism has sort of been channeled into relatively progressive things like the Council of Canadians or even David Orchard in his good days. But in the United States and in Europe, you have far-right politicians, fascists, who are anti-Semites, and there are alliances being made. And I don't think we should understand, this is something that Jay Sakai mentions in his article, Aryan Politics and the Fight Against the WTO, that these fascists are organized. And they're organized amongst the white working class. And when you have a situation where on April 16th, the year 2000, Pat Buchanan, an anti-Semite, a fascist, someone who was engaging in racist rhetoric against China and prior to that against Mexico, takes and shares a stage in a mass mobilization with the AFL-CIO, with the Teamsters, with someone from Students Against Sweatshops, there's a problem there. And I don't think we should be tweaking or being strategic about how we engage with people like Buchanan. I think our strategy is we don't, and we oppose them. And there's that tendency, I think, that's understated because I don't think we see it here in Canada as much as it is in the United States. Even in the fast-track battle, which is considered a progressive battle, I came across an email a couple of days ago where they have three different types of letters that you should write. One, which is the right-wing letter, one, which is the center letter, which is the left-wing letter, because the fast-track battle brings together people like Jesse Helms, a racist and a fascist with, I guess, more progressive Congress people. So you're pandering to that right-wing element, which is something that we should be clearly opposing. So to quote a dead Russian who I won't name, what is to be done? To refer to Patrick referred to Jubilee South, and there's another article I take a lot of, I steal off of Alejandro Bendaña from Jubilee South in Nicaragua wrote an article called Reductionism and the Pitfalls of the Reform Agenda, and he talks about the need to name, which addresses this idea of the asymmetry of class politics internationally. He says, the first step towards stopping the violence on the broadest level, you know, military violence, environmental violence, the violence of poverty, the violence of capitalism and imperialism, the first step towards stopping the violence is to recognize the existence of an insidious structure that deepens and reproduces social, economic, and gender inequality along with environmental degradation. The very real phenomena of exploitation, oppression, and intervention are deliberately obscured by labels and terms that distort a moral understanding in reaction to that reality. Colonialism, he's naming names now, colonialism or neocolonialism, has shown historical capacity to renew itself in forms, not in essence, and in no small part by renaming itself in some innocuous fashion, often drawing from moral and development work itself. So we need to name names, and I'm not going to be condescending, and I think we all know what those names are, but we should be really clear about them. And again, to quote from Bendaña, we need to be wary of the pitfalls of the reform agenda in the North, where what ends up happening is an indirect fight, which is fudged over, right? Because a lot of people talk about the anarchists and some of the radical stuff going on, but there's a whole mess of things going on at these demonstrations. And that element that talks about being anti-capitalist or whatever is very marginalized, if you really look at it. So to not have those indirect fights, to realize that a lot of the reform agenda is collusion with those very exploitive systems that caused the oppression in the first place. So to reject that reform agenda clearly, but not in a sectarian way, rather by asserting an alternative radical politics very openly, not fudging it and not having those indirect fights, and really taking the lead from the South. So to wrap up here, I've also been asked to address this idea of international solidarity between the South and the North and sites of struggle and sort of contours or parameters for this. And I don't want to sit here and propose some sort of new Comintern, you know, instead of getting its directions from Moscow, it'll get its directions from, I don't know, some special IR, an internet chat room. But I'd like to maybe give some notions of what this solidarity would be like, and this is nothing original, but I guess it needs to be said. I think what needs to be done is break the barrier between sites of struggle in the South and North, because those sites of struggle are being mediated through NGOs and through labor unions who have the resources to travel and to mediate. And we have to break that down and not see the South, which is how it's often seen, and activists from the South, as decoration for our protests. So you bring up a couple of speakers and you decorate your protests and sprinkle them up with with this exotic South, while what's really happening is that the North is dominating the analysis. We need to network, of course. We need to name names. And I guess to be very specific, I'll talk about one particular effort that has a bad acronym but has a lot of good politics, I think. The bad acronym is PGA, which up here is like the Professional Golfers Association, but is also the acronym for People's Global Action, which is an attempt to have an international network taking its direction from the South and leadership from the South while maintaining a radical politics and not being mediated through NGOs or through governments, but rather trying to create direct links between those sites of struggle in the South and in the North, direct struggle. PGA dates as far back as 1998, believe it or not, to the anti-WTO protests, the riots in Geneva, essentially, against the WTO one full year before Seattle. The hallmarks of PGA are, you know, when you compare it to, say, the Hemispheric Social Alliance, or even a lot of what's coming out of Porto Alegre, the hallmarks, you know, sort of stand out as more radical, I guess, making a very clear rejection of the WTO. The next PGA conference, which is in Cochabamba this September, is hoping to, at least a lot of activists in the PGA network are hoping to have a very clear rejection of capitalism, period. because PGA comes out of the struggle against the WTO originally. So it has those principles. It has a strong emphasis on direct action, on civil disobedience, a rejection of reformism, a confrontational attitude against power structures. PGA gave the impetus for the so-called first International Day of Action, or at least the first self-conscious International Day of Action against capitalism, which predates Seattle, by the way, June 18th, 1999, which was infamous, I guess, for the riots in London and the more minor riots in Eugene, Oregon, and then the November 30th actions in A16 and M1, et cetera, et cetera. I like to distinguish the PGA network, because we are talking about southern and northern networks. I like to distinguish it from other networks, networks that exist within the UN, which I consider to be a way of, and Patrick kind of alluded to this, a way of reinforcing the system or giving a gloss while these structures of oppression can continue to function, but with a happy face. The Hemispheric Social Alliance on the American and the Americas level, which asks for social clauses, and even the Porto Alegre efforts, which has, I think, some organizational problems because it's not very transparent. It seems to be led by the PT in Brazil and French academics, which is not the the makings for a real grassroots international movement. PGA, I guess one of its faults is it's so horizontal, but it does that because it attempts to be a network and not try to replace something or create what I said before, a common turn. And again, its analysis is a very clear rejection. It's been questioning, or at least groups within PGA have been questioning this idea of days of action, which are very much a northern phenomenon, although there are, of course, actions in the south, but if you just name where these large mobilizations have happened, they have been in the north, in Prague, in Genoa, in Seattle, etc. And instead, they're moving toward the idea of sustained actions, and Patrick alluded again to this, the idea of sustained actions that link the north and south in a genuine way, and not in some false way where we're just supposed to boycott a given product here, and then that way we're showing solidarity. In other words, asserting our consumer privilege, and in that way somehow we're being in solidarity with the South. The three things that PGA targeted, and this came out of the Prague meetings, were sustained actions on water, on land, and on Plan Colombia. And Plan Colombia, much like the whole issue around AIDS and AIDS drugs, provides an interesting example of a genuine link between North and South, because it allows at least, well, I mean, Canada's linked to militarization in Colombia as well, but, I mean, to address, for Northern activists, to address hegemony in the North. And also the whole idea of the drug war. Drug war not just in Colombia, but the war on drugs in cities, in inner cities in the United States. And what PJ also attempts to do is to break barriers between northern and southern activists by putting a strong emphasis on having these international gatherings where people can actually see the terrain of struggle both in the north and the south, and by this idea of caravans and people hearing the voices directly without it being mediated or this privileged superstar network of southern voices. To go back to my when I was addressing India before, something that really frustrated activists in India was the way that Vandana Shiva becomes the voice of India in the north, which is the phenomenon I'm talking about. And while Vandana Shiva does a lot of great work, there's a lot of voices we're not hearing about. So hopefully I gave you some food for thought there. And if you have any questions about PGA, because the next conference is in Cochabamba this September, and we're hoping to really develop the North American network and create this genuine link between North and South on a radical, with a radical basis of unity, please do get in touch. And with that, I'll turn it over to the next speaker. Thanks.